The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'm going to be reading articles principally from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. This is the March 2022 issue of the Health Letter. And the first article I'm going to read is entitled Breast Density. After your last mammogram, you received a letter saying that your breast tissue is dense, a factor that increases your risk of breast cancer. The letter went on to encourage you to talk to your healthcare provider about supplemental breast cancer screening options. Currently, 38 states in the United States require that women with dense breasts be notified about that density after they have a mammogram. But these notifications sometimes can leave more questions than answers. How does breast density relate to breast cancer risk? Is mammography enough if you have dense breasts? And what other options are out there? Read on for more information about breast density and supplemental breast cancer screening. Breast tissue is composed of glands that produce milk that are called lobules, thin tubes that carry the milk from the lobules to the nipple, which are called ducts, and supportive tissue around the lobules and ducts that give the breasts their shape. The tissues surrounding these lobules and ducts may range from fat to fibrous tissue. It's the presence of a proportionally higher amount of fibrous and glandular tissue rather than fat that makes the breast tissue dense. Breast density isn't based on the size or shape of the breasts or how they feel. It can only be seen with imaging. Fatty breast tissue appears dark on a mammogram, while dense breast tissue is solid and white. The radiologist who analyzes your mammogram determines the ratio of fatty or primarily fat, non-dense tissue to dense tissue and assigns a level of breast density. Your breast density is described using a reporting system called Breast Imaging Reporting and Data System. The other name for this is BI-RADS and is recorded in your mammogram report, often using letters. And the letters are A through D. A means almost entirely fatty. The breasts are almost entirely composed of fat. This is true of about 1 in 10 women. The second possibility is B, which means scattered areas of fibroglandular density. This level indicates that there are some scattered areas of density, but the majority of the breast tissue is not dense. About 4 in 10 women have this result. So in other words, half of women are going to have almost entirely fatty breasts or breasts with scattered areas of fibroglandular density. Then the third result is heterogeneously dense. This is the C result. This level indicates that there are several areas of tissue that are not dense, but that much of the breast is dense. And about 40% of women have this result. And then finally, there is D, which means extremely dense. This level indicates that nearly all the breast tissue is dense. About 1 in 10 women have this result. Women in the last true groups, in other words, C and D, the heterogeneously dense or extremely dense, are said to have dense breasts. Dense breasts are common. Overall, about 43% of women between ages 40 and 74 have dense breasts. Why it matters. Breast density factors into the breast cancer risk equation in a couple of ways. First, mammograms are harder to read in women with dense breasts. That's because the solid white areas of dense tissue can hide cancerous tumors, which also appear white on a mammogram. This is known as the masking effect. Because of this effect, women with dense breasts are more likely to have a tumor missed during screening mammography. They're also more likely to have a cancer diagnosed in the period between on-time routine screenings, interval breast cancer. Secondly, breast density is an independent risk factor for breast cancer. The cancer risk of women with very dense breasts is more than 5 times higher than that of women with mostly fatty breasts. Although density tends to decline with age, research still associates increased density with an increased risk of cancer that's spread beyond the ducts or lobules, in other words, invasive breast cancer, in women 65 and older. So when may mammography not be enough? Mammograms are the gold standard for breast cancer screening. Regular mammograms are proved to help find breast cancer in early stages, when treatment is most effective. Recommendations on the starting age and frequency of mammogram screening vary among healthcare organizations. At the Mayo Clinic, care providers offer annual mammograms beginning at age 40. But mammography may not be enough for women with dense breasts. For these women, supplemental screenings can help to highlight areas of concern. These tests may also detect tumors at an earlier stage in women with dense breasts, allowing for more effective treatments. If you've been told that you have dense breasts, talk to your provider about whether supplemental screening is right for you, and if so, which type would be best. Tools like breast cancer risk assessment calculators may be used to determine your lifetime risk of breast cancer. What are the supplemental screening options? Well, there are several that may be recommended in addition to traditional mammography. And these include 3D mammography, which is also called digital breast tomosynthesis. With this technology, an X-ray camera moves in an arc over the breast to collect multiple images, which are then combined to create a 3D picture of the breast. This allows the radiologist to better see through areas of density. At some healthcare centers, including the Mayo Clinic, 3D mammography is now the primary screening tool used for all women, regardless of breast density. But that's not true everywhere. A second screening option is breast ultrasound. Ultrasound uses sound waves to produce images of structures within the body. The American College of Radiology recommends ultrasound as an optional screening tool for women with dense breasts who are at average to intermediate risk of breast cancer. Breast ultrasound may also be recommended for high-risk women who can't have magnetic resonance imaging. However, some facilities, including the Mayo Clinic, offer ultrasound for supplemental screening because of its limitations. And these limitations include a high rate of false positive results. In other words, the result of the test suggests that a cancer is present, but it actually is not. Another possibility is to do molecular breast imaging, or MBI. With molecular breast imaging, a radioactive tracer is injected into a vein in the arm. This tracer is readily taken up by breast cancer cells. A special camera is then used to detect radiation released by the tracer. To limit radiation exposure, it's generally recommended that MBI be done no more than every other year, in addition to annual mammography. And then there's magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI. An MRI machine uses a magnet and radio waves to create pictures of the interior of your breast. It involves lying still on a table inside a tube while the images are collected for as long as an hour. Before a breast MRI, you may have a gadolinium-based contrast agent injected into a vein in your arm. This agent helps to clearly show details within the breast tissue. The American College of Radiology recommends annual breast MRI in addition to annual mammography for women at high risk of breast cancer, but not solely based on breast density. Then there's contrast-enhanced mammography. For this newer test, an injection of a contrast dye is given before you have two sets of mammograms. The dye helps display any areas of concern in the X-ray images. It's not currently available for supplemental screening of women with dense breasts and an average risk of cancer, but clinical trials are underway to determine its role in breast imaging. The article goes on to have a table, and this table goes over all the many different ways of doing supplemental breast imaging. It points out that, as was said previously, breast ultrasound has a high false positive rate. Molecular breast imaging has a higher radiation exposure than standard mammography. Magnetic resonance imaging is time-consuming, not widely available, quite expensive, and often not covered by insurance. And contrast-enhanced mammograms simply aren't widely available and may be unsuitable for those with an iodine contrast allergy. So it's clear from all this that this is going to be an area that's going to change as more information is gathered. Now the Mayo Clinic health letter goes on to describe a health tip entitled Going for the Burn While Walking. During the COVID-19 pandemic, many people took up walking as a way to get away from it all, if only around the block. Walking is a good exercise that works major muscle groups. It doesn't require any special equipment or special training. If you'd like to kick your walking routine up a notch, here are some things to think about. First of all, know the difference between a casual stroll, a brisk walk, and overdoing it. Breathing easily means your walk is casual. If your speech becomes halting, you're walking at a brisk pace. You may be overdoing it if you can't talk at all while you're walking. Think about alternating periods of brisk and leisurely walking. This type of interval training can improve your cardiovascular fitness, and the health benefits add up in less time than a standard stroll. Think about adopting what's called a fitness stride when you walk. Keep your head up, look forward, relax your shoulders, bend your elbows slightly, swing your arms, keep your back straight and walk smoothly, rolling your foot from heel to toe. Then you might think about amping it up. Once you're more physically fit, take a slightly longer stride. Push off with your toes. Vigorously swing your arms. Use the muscles in your upper body. If you're able, try hiking, choosing a route that takes you uphill or carrying a load like a backpack while you're walking. But don't use ankle weights. They put too much strain on your leg muscles. Think about using a pedometer. These can help you to set and meet fitness goals. A good goal is 30 minutes of physical activity or 10,000 steps every day. Now, the next article in the Mayo Clinic health letter is entitled The Emotional Impact of Diabetes. How can you learn to cope? You're late for work and racing out the door when the questions start. Did I eat too much for breakfast or not enough? Did I take the right amount of insulin? Did I remember to pack my supplies? When will I find time for a workout? Life with diabetes can be demanding. Along with daily responsibilities like monitoring your blood sugar or managing medications, you may worry about your diet, long-term health, or the impact of diabetes on your family. There are periods when you're up for the challenge and other times when you may feel kind of discouraged. You might even feel at times that diabetes has sucked all the enjoyment out of your life. Even though diabetes is part of your life, it doesn't have to be in the center stage. By being proactive, you can overcome challenges, move past the obstacles, and enjoy your life. Many people feel stress about the challenges of dealing with diabetes and other chronic conditions. Sometimes these feelings can be overwhelming, causing what experts call diabetes distress or diabetes burnout. Although these phrases are often used interchangeably, they refer to two different but related experiences. If you're often worried, frustrated, angry, or stressed out because of diabetes, you may be experiencing diabetes distress. Diabetes distress is linked to not feeling in control or on top of your condition. It can develop when the demands of diabetes seem to take too much of your energy, resources, time, or knowledge. As one person says, diabetes distress is like constantly fighting with your body in a battle that you're not winning, no matter what you do. Even as you do your best to care for yourself, negative feelings about the pressures of your condition drag you down and affect your sense of well-being. If you feel worn out by the demands of diabetes and want to be done with it, you may be experiencing diabetes burnout. As one person put it, I'm just really exhausted, and I don't want to do anything with it. I don't care if my blood sugar is high. I don't care if I don't have enough insulin. Diabetes burnout can take different forms at different times in your life. You might stop being careful about your diet, or you might even purposely sabotage it. You might check your blood sugar less regularly, or stop checking it altogether. Or you might become lax about taking insulin or other medications. You might find that diabetes burnout comes in waves. Sometimes you feel perfectly capable of carrying on, while at other times you may want to quit, and may even step back from engaging in self-treatment. Burnout and distress are common responses to life with diabetes and not signs of failure, but they can feed into one another and affect your motivation, making it hard to manage your condition. This can lead to setbacks, which can lead to more burnout and more distress. By being proactive, you can overcome this cycle of burnout and distress. Try these suggestions. Get professional support. If you've been struggling with feelings of distress for several weeks, or you find that you're starting to pull back from your self-care routine, it may be time to seek help from your diabetes care team. Be honest about the struggles you're experiencing and the burdens that diabetes places on you. Your team may help you to develop strategies to ease those burdens and work through barriers. They may also recommend a therapist who can help you develop greater confidence in your ability to handle life's hurdles. Share what you're going through. Don't isolate yourself when you're having a bad day or bottle up your worries, angers, or sadness. Talk to your family, your friends, or other people with diabetes. This can ease your distress and help you to see the bigger picture. It can be as simple as saying that you need to vent a little after a stressful day, or that you need a bit of extra support. Most people are going to be willing to listen. Also, share the load. Some people living with diabetes find it helpful to involve their loved ones in their daily care. At your request, family members can remind you to take your medications, help you to monitor your blood glucose levels, count your carbohydrates at meals, or change your insulin pump. This type of hands-on support can give you a break and even bring you closer to your loved ones. You might also consider asking extended family members for assistance with meals or obtaining medications or devices, even discussing how to handle costs with someone you trust can be a help. Simplify what you can. With the guidance of your diabetes care team, you may be able to change your medication regimen or introduce new technologies into your care routine. Devices like a continuous glucose monitor and an insulin pump might make it easier to maintain your blood sugar. Make changes one at a time. If you need to make changes to your eating habits and physical activity, choose the one that will be easiest for you to achieve and tackle it first. Then move on to the next one when you're ready. And be kind to yourself. No one gets it 100% right. If you have a bad day or a stretch of bad days, show yourself compassion and keep moving forward. Life isn't static, and neither is diabetes. Your condition may change over time, causing your treatment plan to shift along with it. Strive to accept what you can't control and aim to take charge of what you can. Have faith in your ability to deal with and adapt to whatever situations you encounter. Along with this article are a couple of shorter articles that are entitled News and Our Views. The first is, the nocebo effect may explain some statin side effects. Statins are drugs that can lower your cholesterol. They're also associated with a decreased risk of heart disease and stroke. Some people report side effects from statins like headaches, nausea, and aches in muscles and joints. These effects are a major reason why people stop taking these potentially life-saving drugs. Recent research found that at least some of these side effects may be due to the nocebo effect, in which people who have a negative expectation about a drug report higher than expected rates of side effects. A study was done in Circulation that looked at side effects reported over 9 years. They found that in people who took statins, subjective side effects, those open to interpretation and commonly associated with a nocebo effect, dramatically outnumbered the measurable side effects. A different study in the New England Journal of Medicine involves 60 older adults who had stopped taking statins due to side effects. Over a year, they cycled monthly through different treatments, taking the drug, taking a placebo, or taking nothing. There was extensive overlap in the symptoms reported by participants, whether they were taking a statin or a placebo. In fact, 90% of the symptom burden attributed to a statin was also experienced when taking the placebo. Mayo Clinic experts say that people with side effects from statins might consider whether the medication is the source. Those who have stopped taking statins due to perceived side effects may want to retry these beneficial drugs. Or they might want to switch to a different statin to see if it's better tolerated. Statins are often recommended for people without a history of heart or blood vessel disease, but with one or more cardiovascular risk factors and a high 10-year risk of heart attack. Statins are also recommended for people with cardiovascular disease related to hardening of the arteries and for people with very high low-density lipoprotein, or LDL, cholesterol. Statins are also recommended for people with diabetes. Dietary supplements come with unknown ingredients and risks. In the pursuit of losing weight and improved energy levels, you may be drawn to pills that are advertised to do just that. They're available online. They don't require a prescription. What's not to like? quite a lot potentially. In a recent study, researchers analyzed commonly used dietary supplements and found that many contained unlisted ingredients, including ones that have been shown to pose serious health risks. This study was done in the Clinical Toxicology Journal and broke down the ingredients in 17 dietary supplements advertised for weight loss or energy enhancement. Researchers identified 9 prohibited stimulants and 8 different mixtures of stimulants in the supplements. One main ingredient in many of the supplements was deuterenol, D-E-T-E-R-E-N-O-L, which has been banned for use by the FDA since 2004 because of serious risks to heart health, including heart attack. The study confirmed that supplements that may cause unhealthy side effects continue to be sold online. One reason is that the regulatory system is somewhat loose. Dietary supplements don't require FDA approval. Supplement companies are responsible for the safety of their products, but they don't have to prove safety or effectiveness to take the products to the market. But they're expected to ensure that their products are free of contaminants and that they're accurately labeled. If a supplement is found to be unsafe, the FDA can issue warnings. Dietary supplements aren't the best route to weight loss or improved energy. Healthy eating, regular exercise, adequate sleep, and other lifestyle factors are more effective and safer. For weight loss, there are FDA-approved drugs that can also be considered. Still, if you want to try a supplement, talk with your healthcare provider before doing so. This is especially important if you have a health problem or take prescription drugs, because certain supplements can interact with those drugs. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.